This show is furnished by Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervy's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervy. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. And now, here's your host, Alan Gervy.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all over the world on KBC.com. I am Alan Gervy, the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn. And today, as usual, I am here to be the managing partner of your life. But I got a guy with me today who can manage your life way better than I can. By the way, before I introduce him, I don't know if you know this, Ben, but Carrie's not here anymore.
Really?
You are Carrie Kasem today.
Remember when I would pretend to be Carrie Kasem?
I do.
It's the power of positive thinking. I got her out. I'm in.
He became Carrie Kasem. He used to put on this high-pitched voice and talk like he was Carrie Kasem, and now he is Carrie Kasem. Well, she's no longer with us, and it's Ben Mycelis. He's partner at Garagos & Garagos. He heads the firm's transactional and civil practice. He's also general counsel for the Big Three Basketball League. He was Variety's Impact Lawyer of the Year for his legal achievements, but not only his legal achievements, but also his philanthropy. Of course, he represented Colin Kaepernick and against the NFL and in his endorsement deal with Nike. And that's going to help us today on our show when we talk about Nike and some of the big corporations. You interned for your uncle, P. Diddy. You got a different color going than P. Diddy, but he worked for Hillary Clinton and he's done a lot of charity work, Kaepernick's Know Your Rights campaign, which is a really important thing for kids to learn about constitutional rights and about other issues that prevail upon them through the legal system. And now, Ben Mycelis, we can talk about this smash success. When you used to be Carrie Kasem here on the show, you were a nothing. Now you come back, and thank you for coming on the show because you are a somebody. You have turned everything upside down. Midas Touch Radio and the Pack. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so me and my brothers during quarantine, we created Midas Touch, which became the largest Democratic political action committee. Me and my two younger brothers, we were just sitting around. We were pissed off by what we saw on TV as Donald Trump was giving these press conferences, and we saw, you know, the destruction of our nation. And so we decided to do something about it. I have the legal background. My younger brother, Brett, is an editor. My other brother is a marketer. We put our talents together.
Jordan, you can say
Jordy,
his name.
Brett. We put our talents together. We created Midas Touch. We officially launched in May. And we've grown now. We've done over 200 videos. The average views of each of our videos is about 2.5 million views per video. And we're on national TV. We have the radio show. We have radio ads. We have billboards. We have the baby Trump blimp and a baby chicken Trump blimp going around the country. We're funding porta potties on election day. We've just been doing a ton to get out the vote. Sent over 3.5 million text messages to voters in swing states. Have raised close to $3 million and essentially deployed all of that money back to ads. And so we've been working really hard to get Biden elected. We think this is an existential threat. And we're humbled by the success, and the support has been overwhelming.
So you are an internet sensation. How does that happen? I mean, you came in here, and Ben's been on the show a number of times, and, you know, really smart attorney, focused on Garagos & Garagos Law. And then in May, all of a sudden, you turn that around. How do you do it?
It's the same work ethic that I put into my cases and my trials. And here I viewed it as you have Donald Trump on trial and my case to the jury is the case to the American people. And you just have to be relentless. You know, we started with one follower, then 1,000, then 100,000. And before we knew it, we had, you know, millions and millions of followers.
But how do you do that? I understand the numbers. What were you doing to turn 100,000 into millions?
It's just putting out good quality content. Our videos, my younger brother, Brett, who's a top editor at The Ellen Show, makes really good videos. My brother, Jordy's a great marketer. And the content is top-notch content that resonated to people. And there really hadn't been a group before of progressives in politics who were aggressive and who punched back.
Aggressive and so, progressives.
Yeah, we call it progressives punch back. And there was no one doing that in this space. And so we filled this niche that didn't exist. People thought we were Republicans because we fought so hard. And, you know, we loved telling our authentic story about who we were as brothers, and we're incredibly transparent, showing how every dollar spent, and we post everything online. And I think that transparency and just good quality work connected with the people.
So we had a couple of women on the show, and I can't remember their name, Shimmer and Shine or something, or Diamonds, and what's their name?
Diamond and Silk.
That's them. So do you have a little more substance than Diamond and Silk?
Yeah, I think that the Diamond and Silk carnival style of politics is what we've seen in the Trump administration. There is no substance there. It's all propaganda. There's no articulation of policy. And every one of the videos that we do use frequently Donald Trump's words and juxtapose it to his actions. Our style really is not even using the narration.
So, Ben, let me ask you this. How are you going to handle the show after Donald Trump gets reelected on Tuesday? What are you going to do?
Well, it's not going to happen, but there's always going to be a role for Midas Touch. The niche that we filled in progressive politics is always going to be there. Our political action committee is always going to be there. The radio show that we have on Sirius XM, Midas Touch Radio, is going to continue, and we want to build out the media arm of Midas Touch as much as possible, increase our follower base, and we want to always be here. You know, we are lifelong Democrats. When this election ends, we're always going to be Democrats, and the values of progressives, education for all, universal health care, are values that we care about. Ironically, those are values that Trump and Republicans are basically running on, claiming they're protecting, you know, pre-existing conditions. All of the things that we care about, they have to co-opt because they don't really believe in those messages. And we need to stand up for those messages and not let, you know, our voice be co-opted and head down this path.
How can you be a lawyer at the same time? Because you're so passionate. I can hear it in your voice. And, you know, I give you credit for that. But for me, being a litigator, it's so all-consuming. How do you do this?
Aided a little bit by the pandemic in that courts have been closed, right? So there's not the trust.
But Mark Garagos isn't closed.
Well, the criminal system
he's
is
been
more
He's been more active during the pandemic than before.
Yeah, but it's the same work ethic that we bring to the cases that we bring to Midas Touch. And when you love it, you find time in the day to do it. And we execute at the highest level. And so if it takes, you know, 8 hours, and those 8 hours would be spending doing something else, I find those 8 hours.
So you didn't get a chance to go trick-or-treating last night?
Oh, no chance for trick-or-treating last night.
Oh, come on. You missed out.
We spent last night making some incredible videos that we're going to be releasing tomorrow. We call it our closing argument of Midas Touch, why vote for Joe Biden. Really going to be talking to, hard to believe that some people are still undecided, but our videos tomorrow that we're going to release, we'll be talking to the remaining undecided voters. It's an election about decency, about compassion. As Biden says, the character of our nation is on the line. And I believe you have just two very different people who are running and very different characters.
You know, sitting here, Ben, with you, I'm starting to reminisce and think about one of my favorite movies, My Dinner with Andre, because you're talking about such important stuff. And in My Dinner with Andre, you know, one of the guys at the table is talking about, you know, going to Tibet and the meaning of life and metaphysics. And then Wallace Shawn answers back and says, "Did I feed my cats today? I can't really remember." And when you're talking about that, I'm thinking, what was I doing last night? I was walking the streets socially distanced with my 6 and 7 year old who were dressed up as zombie cheerleaders. And I was dressed up actually as a zombie cheerleader myself. And we were going, trying to figure out whether we were going to have M&Ms or Snickers at the next house. And there was only about maybe 5% of the houses that had candy sitting out there. So I'm not sure about the meaning of life, but I got a lot out of that, you know, time that I spent with my kids last night together. So I'm glad you're out there doing something for the whole world, for the whole country, for the city of LA, something that's really important. But I do want to say that there are other things in life as well.
Well, I mean, as we did a billboard in Vegas, those other things in life have come to a standstill when there are, you know, poor policies. And our billboard in Vegas talked about the things that were canceled, being able to be present at a family member's funeral, being able to be present at a wedding, being able to be at a bar mitzvah. Each one of those examples I gave you were things that I couldn't do in these past 6 months, you know, with when a family member passed away, when a family member had a bar mitzvah and had a wedding, and maybe I got to see it on Zoom, but I haven't got to see, you know, even Brett, who I make these videos with. I haven't got to see Jordy. So there are other things in life, but when politics encroaches on those other things, that's what made me say, I got to do something, because I can't take for granted, and we always took for granted, that these other things just happened, that you got to trick or treat, and you got to go to Halloween, that you got to go to weddings, that you got to go to sports games.
And so you're saying you can blame that on Trump and the Republicans?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. I'll tell you this. He said in March that there were 15 cases and they were all going to go away by the summer in the heat. There are 9 million cases. When you're that off, when you're 900,000% off on numbers and they impact life and death, yeah, you take the blame when you are the president of the United States. But he's not responsible for the creation of the virus.
Right.
But certainly the response and then the lying and misinformation to the people. Absolutely 100% responsible.
Yeah, I'm not going to comment on that. But, you know, it is a tough thing to get rid of. It's not so easy. And I'm not so sure that, and I don't know what others would do, whether they're Democrats or Republicans. I happen to wear a mask all the time. I believe in social distancing. That's me. But I don't know that a different administration would, I'm sure they'd have an impact, but I don't know it's going to be as big an impact as you're talking about.
Well, look at this. Laura Ingraham from Fox News,
yes,
she was wearing a mask at a Trump rally. That tells you all you need to know. And he called her out for wearing the mask. She knows that she's supposed to wear a mask, and he knows you should wear a mask. And at the very least, we're America and we try. That's all we ask for, is that we try to contain it, and we don't wave the white flag.
I'm Canadian, and we're doing much better in Canada. You know, so it can be a different mentality as well. It's a tough subject. We've got a great show. We're going to divert from what we're talking about now for a few minutes. But first of all, just tell everyone, before we go to break, how they can hear Midas Touch.
You can find us on Twitter at Midas Touch, MEIDASTOUCH, MidasTouch.com. You could check us out on all social media platforms.
All right. We've got two Rhodes Scholars, two Harvard graduates coming up after the break. Joel Backen and Casey Sepp.
Welcome back to Gervie's Law. Turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
All right, we're back. I'm Alan Gervy. Wait a minute, finally you're playing a good song. Good job. I'm here with Ben Mycelis. He really went off during the first part. Nice to hear, Ben, the passion. And that's what he had, that passion when he represented Colin Kaepernick. He was going to protect Colin's rights. And definitely when it came to the Nike deal, Ben, you negotiated his Nike deal?
The Nike deal, Audible deal. We did a deal with Disney. So all of Colin's deals, you know, I serve
so
as Colin.
So are those corporations, like, are they horrible? Are they psychopaths? Are they just jerks?
Well, it's no. It's been a major part of our philosophy to do our part in trying to change the cultural dynamics of these corporations. Our deals aren't content deals. We try to make them overall deals that impact the culture. And that's what's really important to
us.
Yeah,
but it sounds like it's fake. Well, fake culture.
Well, one of the things that we build in that's very important is to make sure we elevate Black and brown creators, writers, directors, producers,
but these corporations
editors
are just using that concept. I mean, come on. You know what? I don't want to talk to you about this. Let's talk to the expert. Let's talk to the guy who really
expert
knows.
Witness time.
The expert witness. He's got the stuff. And I'll tell you, we're lucky today. We got two Rhodes Scholars on because later in the show, we have Casey Sepp on, who wrote the book Furious Hours: Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee. She went to Harvard. And she was a Rhodes Scholar, did her MPhil in theology. And now we want to welcome to Gervie's Law Joel Bakken, who is a professor at law at the University of British Columbia in my home country. He's a former Rhodes Scholar as well. And he went to Harvard and Dalhousie, where he has law degrees, Dalhousie in Canada. He clerked for the Chief Justice. Brian, did you know that's a big deal? Clerking for a Chief Justice.
Absolutely.
You never did that, did you?
No, I never clerked for a Chief Justice.
That's in the Supreme Court of Canada. I remember I did steal a piece of paper that said, from the desk of Chief Justice Brian Dixon, when I went and toured the Supreme Court of Canada. So that's as close as I got to Brian Dixon. Joel Bakken has written some of the most critically acclaimed works. First, back in 2004, The Corporation, The Pathological Pursuit of Profit and Power. And then most recently, The New Corporation, How Good Corporations Are Bad for Democracy. His second feature film based on it was The New Corporation, the unfortunately necessary sequel. I guess it's different than, did you watch the sequel with Borat?
I did watch the Borat sequel, and it was not a tuck.
I got to tell you, The New Corporation, the unfortunately necessary sequel, is so much better than the Borat sequel. But enough about that. Joel right. Bakken, and welcome right. to
okay,
Gervie's
I've
Law.
I've got to chime in here.
Can you I got to. Go ahead. I need you to chime in. You know, we're talking, and by the way, we're here in studio. They're saying now streaming on Prime Video, Borat's his sequel. Your sequel is so important, and I know it was important for you to make it, and it's kind of sad that you had to, but tell us the origins of how you came about to make The New Corporation the unfortunately necessary sequel.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I am a law professor. I teach about corporations, and I teach about corporate law. And back in the late 1990s, I started thinking, this is really interesting. We've got this institution that we confer legally personhood on, and then we imbue it with a character that, you know, always has to pursue its own self-interest, basically always has to advance shareholder value. So if that were a human person, we'd probably diagnose as a psychopath. Here's a person that is incapable of not acting in its own self-interest. So wrote that book, made that film. And then I was at the 10th anniversary screening of the film. The film did great, won Best Documentary at Sundance and tons of awards and all of that in the book, too. So that was great. But I was at the 10th anniversary screening of the film, and everybody's like celebrating, breaking out champagne. Great film, you know, it's had a great run. And I thought to myself, what the heck are we celebrating here? Every single issue we looked at in the film has gotten worse. I mean, climate change, the degrading of democracy, inequality, all of it's gotten worse. Corporations have gotten bigger. They become more powerful. And the difference is that around the time the film came out, corporations started to say, you know, we're the good guys now. We're going to solve the world's problems. And I heard your conversation earlier, like concerns about racism and all of that. We are going to provide solutions now. We're not going to cause the problems anymore. So I thought, okay, this is really weird that we've got a world that's going off the rails. And this was 2013, not even now,
right.
A lot worse. So a world that's going off the rails and corporations are saying, you know, we're going to save today. Governments don't really matter anymore. And so here we go. And so I thought, you know, obviously the first film didn't do the trick. So unfortunately it was necessary now to do a sequel. So wrote another book and made another film.
Ben, so what do I do as a, you know, as a deal maker? I mean, you've heard that I did the Nike deal. I did a deal with Audible and I did a deal with Disney. I genuinely try to make these deals from a good place. I try to build in contractually every protection I can to elevate black and brown directors, creators, editors, you know, across the board. And I try to create as much ownership as possible. Is that, am I doing the right thing, or should I not even be dealing with companies?
Yes. I take my hat off to you. These are good things to do. There are a bunch of things that I don't say, and there's one thing that I do say. The things I don't say is, number one, I don't say the people who work in corporations are bad. I don't say they're psychopaths. They're no worse than people who work in any other organization, universities, churches, trade unions. People are people, and they're decent people. So don't say people are bad. And I don't say people that are within corporations shouldn't try to be better and try to be good, and that people who are dealing with corporations like you are, service providers, lawyers, et cetera, shouldn't try to nudge them and push them in a better direction. I don't say any of that. I think that's all great. My problem is the view that I discovered in doing my research. I went to the World Economic Forum at Davos. I talked to sort of top corporate CEOs, all kinds of people. And what I learned was this, that it's this sort of movement of corporate goodness is not just about corporations being good. There's always this other argument that's made that because we're good now, it's okay for us to have all this power. In fact, it's okay for us to regulate ourselves. We don't need to be regulated because we're good now. It's okay for us to run schools and water systems and to privatize everything because we're good now. We're publicly minded and we can do a better job than governments. And we shouldn't really be paying taxes because all those public services should be in the marketplace rather than being provided by government. So what I found is that there are kind of two pieces to this whole trend. One is corporations should be good, and I'm all for that. Of course, it's better if corporations are better than if they're not. But two is the sort of larger political shift seems to be that corporations should have more power, they should have more impunity, they should be less regulated. So you see the leaders of this movement, Jamie Dimon, Howard Schultz, all the Paul Polman, the leaders of these good corporations at the same time in their like dirty shirts lobbying the Trump administration for more deregulation, for even more tax cuts than he's already given them, and applauding the economic policies that they're getting under the Trump administration while bemoaning the social policies on immigration, race, et cetera. So that's what I'm objecting to. That's what I have a problem with. I mean, I'll just give you one final example and then let you guys chime in. But I spoke with Richard Edelman, who is kind of the guru of all business gurus. And he's a guy who says corporations should be good. They should pursue purpose. Interviewed him in Davos. And he said to me this, and I'm quoting, he said, "I'm not much of a believer in political citizenship. I believe in the power of the marketplace. And now that corporations are good actors, they can sort of fill the voids," as he described it, "left by government and be agents for change." That's scary.
Yeah.
Because that's saying, I don't care about democracy.
It's so fraudulent, too. But we have to take a break. I wish we didn't, because I know Ben and I both have a lot to say. We both deal with it all the time. I deal with insurance companies all the time. And I got to tell you, I cannot trust them. They screw my clients constantly, yet they try to hold themselves out as holier than thou and giving to all of these causes when they can't even run their business in a way that they should, because they're looking for ways to make money. And I want to ask you after the break whether we should just accept that, because that's the free market. That's really what question is begged here, rather than what Ben and I both see as a bunch of phonies when these corporations speak out, like you've talked about in your book and in the film The New Corporation. You're listening to Gurvey's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
You're listening to Gurvey's Law, the intersection of law and life on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
It's now or never.
That's
a good song going into Tuesday.
It is.
That's getting me. I'm going to have to get this clear to do a Midas Touch video with this in the background.
You like this?
I like it.
Now it's turning into a little bit of an election campaign here.
You know what? It is now or never. Are we going to have more privatization, more government being co-opted by business? Or are we going to move in a more socially responsible
and more
direction?
Friction? I mean, you got to consider what's going on in this country. And thankfully, I guess for Joel, he's in Canada, in Vancouver. We're talking to professional jazz guitarist Joel Backen. Actually, and by the way, Rhodes Scholar and Harvard and Dalhousie Law degree.
And Oxford. Did you see John Cornyn there? Did you see him in that graduate program, Joel?
I didn't bump into him, no.
Not yet. Well, you can always get another law degree. The book is called The New Corporation, How Good Corporations and Bad Are Bad for Democracy. And the film is The New Corporation, The Unfortunately Necessary Sequel. You know, recently The Social Dilemma came out on Netflix. A lot of people were talking about that. When you were doing your research for the book, were you finding that there were a lot of former CEOs and former management people in these corporations that were speaking out and talking about what really is going down in these corporations, Joel?
Not really.
Well, what's the difference? Why are the tech people talking and corporate America isn't?
I think that, you know, a lot of people attracted to the tech sector. And you're talking about the people who have come to be known as the refuseniks.
Right.
You know, the former engineers at Google and Facebook and who are kind of coming out and saying this is just a disaster for democracy. And actually, in doing my research, I tried to get some of them in the film, but we just couldn't make it happen in terms of timing and our shoot production schedule and stuff. But they're fascinating people. And I think that, you know, Silicon Valley attracts a lot of really bright people and a lot of people who have a sense that they want a good world. They want a decent world and that they believe technology will help us get there. And it definitely will, and it has. Technology certainly has its uses. It's hard to imagine living without it. But I think what they find when they get there is that the culture of these corporations and their focus on the bottom line and their willingness to do anything, you know, whether it's Facebook or it's Google or it's Amazon, that money-driven culture kind of just contradicts the ideals that brought them there. And that's why they blow the whistle, I think.
And Joel, what do you think about this? The framing of everything as capitalism when, in fact, is what we really have capitalism when you have the government really kind of tilting the scales for corporations and continuing to bail them out? You know, I wonder if we have this vision of capitalism, but what we've seen yet again with COVID is that the first people who get bailed out, I say people because of the recognition of corporations as right. being people, right. is that the scales get tilted and who gets the bailouts again? Them in undisclosed forms. And then we're told that the individuals get a $1,200 check and the politicians abandon. That's not capitalism. You know, so when we're attacking the system, should we be reframing it and just saying that this is a form of really kind of government controlled, tilt the scale, fake socialism for billionaires?
Yeah, well, I mean, George Bernard Shaw came up with the phrase socialism for the rich and capitalism for the poor. And that's kind of it, right? I mean, that the corporate sector and the rich get all kinds of help from the government and from the state. While, you know, as you say, maybe you're lucky to get a $1,200 check if you're an ordinary working person in this COVID situation. But yeah, it's absolutely appalling. You know, corporations saying we're going to save the world and all this. And as soon as COVID hits, they're in line up for bailouts. That's what they're doing. They're making massive profits in the case of the tech sector. And ordinary people are suffering like crazy. Stocks are soaring. You know, it's insane. And I think there's a real fallacy in the whole notion of a free market. There's no such thing as a free market. You can't have a market. You know this as a lawyer. You can't have a market unless you have property rights. Well, what are property rights? They're the willingness of the state to enforce your right to a particular patch of land or to some other kind of property, intellectual or otherwise. Contract rights, what are those? What about corporations? All these things are created by the state. The state creates markets. And so from that basic insight, you get to the idea that there's no place where the state is absent or where the government is absent. The only question is whose interests are being served by state and government power. And in our current system, it is mainly the corporate sector and the wealthy, and ordinary people are not at all served by government. And they're then sold this idea that, you know, oh, the market is free. You know, we should have a free market. Well, free for you in the sense that you're in free fall if you're an ordinary person. But for the, it's a free lunch, basically, for the corporate sector and the rich.
Let me ask you this, and I want to play devil's advocate for a second, Joel. Why should the corporations care? A disclaimer here, my undergraduate degree's in moral philosophy, and, you know, why should they have any morality? Isn't it their job to make money, and when they have, you know, the stockholders, and they need to produce, why should they care if they can make money, and why should what you're writing and what you're producing in your films really be important?
You're not playing devil's advocate. I mean, that's the argument I make in the book is they're set up to make money. They're legally required to make money. There's a reason for that. Corporations are great vehicles for financing large industrial enterprises. That's why they were created in the mid-19th century. And I agree. I mean, I think the real problem is that we're expecting them to be good and assuming that they can be. They actually can't be. So what we should do is see them for what they are.
Right.
They're vehicles for financing enterprise, and stop thinking about them as, you know, some kind of social, you know, beneficial kind of institution. They're not that. But if that's the position we're going to take about them and we can't expect them to be good, then how can we ensure they don't do harm? Well, we need to regulate them.
Right,
that's
right.
Why we have democratic governments.
Yeah,
we, the citizens, should be setting the rules by which they play.
You know, and that's the beauty of your book and your film, is talking about phonies. You know, I'm hearkening back on my degree in moral philosophy. I can't stand phonies. I want to do the right thing. And if you want to call a spade, that's what you should be doing. You should be going out there, making money, and not apologizing for it, and not pretending like you are the, you know, you're interested in social change. You're interested in all the issues that Ben is working so hard for. It's just not true. We got to let you go. But before we do, Joel, I want to ask you about this election. First of all, why hasn't there been more money from the corporations behind Trump policies? Because that's what's going to benefit them. And who's going to win? And I was going to say on Tuesday, but whenever the election results roll in.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really interesting question. There's no question that the corporate sector has been cheering Trump on and asking for more in terms of tax policy and cuts and deregulation and all that. But I also think that I think Ben said earlier in the show, you know, things are a mess in the U.S. There is, you know, the division, the polarization is leading to a dysfunctional world. The lack of dealing with COVID properly is leading to things that are really going to start to hurt businesses' bottom line. I think, you know, the corporate sector is pretty savvy and knows that stability is probably better than utter dysfunction and breakdown. They also know that a Joe Biden administration is not going to cause them too much trouble, is, you know, hardly radical. So I think it probably is a good business call to try to end Trump's tenure in the administration.
Interesting.
When I think, look, the goal of a corporation is to make money. Donald Trump's corporations have all not made money, and he's run America the same way he's run his corporations, which is bankrupting it.
Well, We'll leave that at there. Joel, did you say who's going to win the election? I didn't catch that.
You didn't ask me. I don't know.
You're just too honest.
I really don't know. I mean, it's such a weird system with the electoral college.
It's really true.
You know? It's very hard.
It's the craziest thing.
Why doesn't he just say it? He's in Canada. He doesn't care.
That it's 100%
chance. You are American.
It's 100% chance.
A, I'm American, and B, if you live next to an elephant, you know.
That's true. True.
So, here's what I say. I say that Biden is going to win the popular vote.
Okay.
That's what I was going to say. There's 100% chance that Biden wins the popular vote by millions. Potentially tens of millions. And the fact that we even have to have a conversation about what's it going to look like in a specific county in Florida or a specific county in Arizona is the strangest political process in the world. I don't think it was ever equipped to deal with the situation we have there. But we'll save that for
I got my kids their Canadian citizenship, so they can do both. All right. So the book's The New Corporation, How Good Corporations Are Bad for Democracy. The film is The New Corporation, the unfortunately necessary sequel. Joel Bakken, thank you so much for being with us today on Gervie's Law.
Thanks, Joel.
Thanks, guys. That's been fun.
All right, take care. We're going to come back with Casey Sepp. You don't want to miss it. Our last segment is going to be fun and interesting. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here, Talk Radio 790 KABC.
The glass is always half full when you're listening to Gervie's Law on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yeah, we're having a good time. We're taking a little break from election stuff and talking about things that really matter.
And how am I doing as your co-host there, Alan? Am I feeling the Casey Kasem void?
Last week, or was it 2 weeks ago, we had Jillian Barbary. So she was a little more, you know, high energy than you, but you're real passionate. And I like that. She talked about her breast cancer and some important stuff, but she also talked about not having a date in 7 years. I think maybe two dates in 7 years. So I'm glad we haven't got to that. We'll leave that for Jillian, and to talk about other things. But here's something that, you know, this is a great book. When you talk about someone coming out with their first book, this is one that you want to read, you want to be proud of, and I know Casey Sepp is very proud of it. She's staff writer at The New Yorker, and we're going from one Rhodes Scholar to another, and from one Harvard grad to another, and the book is called Furious Hours, and then Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee, and I know Casey likes to talk about the subtitle because it explains what it is. Furious Hours, it has an interesting connotation to it, but Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee. Casey Sepp, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I of course, thought when you were going to talk about a first book, you were going to talk about To Kill a Mockingbird, which, you know, certainly puts every other debut author to shame.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, because if Harper Lee would have finished The Reverend, a book that she had worked on quite a bit and really put the backstory together, you might not have had this book for your first book. It would have already been done by Harper Lee.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, I have to say, over the years that I was working on my book, I was, of course, always thrilled by the idea and a little terrified by the idea that her manuscript would be discovered and that her version would come out ahead of mine. Because you're right, this is this true crime project. You know, she had worked on the reporting for a year and spent years trying to write it. So there was always this kind of possibility that the Harper Lee version would come out. But it was so far never been found. So, you know, the closest we get is the version I write in the book.
It's such an intriguing story. Tell us a little bit about Reverend Willie Maxwell. And as lawyers, Ben and I, being lawyers, we don't understand how was he getting away, assuming, and of course we use accused of killing relatives to obtain insurance benefits, a number of them, maybe six of them, alleged murders. But how do you get away with that from one wife to another to a cousin, taking out insurance policies, then killing them off and collecting? Were you shocked when you went to Alabama and
and research this story?
Absolutely. I mean, these murders took place from 1970 to 1977. So, you know, we're not talking about the 19th century. Alabama had one of the most sophisticated forensic laboratories in the country. You know, they were doing full toxicological reports on these cases. There were big investigations. Things were above board. But in some instances, you know, these deaths weren't even officially declared homicide and no cause of death could be determined. And these were very strange cases on the criminal side, but even on the civil side, too, because as you've alluded, there was this motive of the life insurance and the Reverend was able to collect about $500,000 in today's dollars in life insurance on two wives, a brother, a nephew, a stepdaughter and a neighbor. And so, you know, that was the big question for this people, for people in this part of Alabama. How did he do it? How did he get away with it? And how on earth was he getting one over on the insurance companies? And, you know, there are a lot of answers to some questions in the book and some others. You see why people made recourse to kind of fantastical explanations like he was a voodoo priest and that's why the police could never catch him and that's why no jury would convict him. But I think that was part of the terror and the kind of intrigue of this case was all along. How was he doing it and how did he get away with it?
And Casey, I'd be very interested to see a book on Willie's lawyer, right? Because Willie's lawyer who helped him, you know, skirt
yeah,
the law.
Sure. I'm talking to two lawyers. How did he get away with it? He had a great lawyer.
But then how did the lawyer represented the person who killed him? How is that not a conflict of interest? And could you, can you tell us about the lawyer?
I've been told in California that it is. I got to do some book events last year and, you know, different states have different ethics rules for their lawyers. And at the time, and actually still today in Alabama, this was not a conflict. But exactly as you said, in 1977, the serial killer was gunned down at the funeral of his last victim. And, you know, gunned down in front of 300 people in the funeral home by a relative of the deceased. So it was a huge deal, 300 witnesses. It was supposed to be a slam dunk case. But lo and behold, the same lawyer who for 10 years had been keeping the serial killer out of prison and helping him collect on these policies turns around and decides he's going to vindicate himself and, you know, revive his own reputation by defending the vigilante as well. And that's the kind of
weren't there other lawyers?
In Alabama, there's one lawyer.
One lawyer.
There's one lawyer you could represent the
person. You know. I mean, he was the go-to guy. You know, if you were accused of a serious crime or you had a run-in, you know, you wrecked your car and you needed help, you know, recovering the insurance, this was the guy. He's a tremendous trial lawyer, you know, really good at picking a jury, just really a performer. And some of that came from, you know, charms he had before he even went to law school. And he'd had this kind of small-time political career in Alabama, very charismatic. You know, people called him the Alabama Matlock. And it worked. You know, it worked over and over again. And he just had a tremendous trial career. And, you know, this was his big case of a lifetime, truly. Nobody thought he would win it. And he walked out with an acquittal by reason of mental insanity, which is, you know, an interesting enough defense. And there's a lot to talk about. There was at the time a lot of aspersions cast on it. But he prevailed and he managed to get the vigilante off, too.
Casey, isn't it crazy when you are being compared to someone like Harper Lee and to Kill a Mockingbird? Now, I know you've said that you kind of lived a life like hers growing up in a sense, and you were from a religious family. But some of the reviews for the book that have all been fantastic talk about this comparison of you and Harper Lee. Southern Living wrote, a compelling hybrid of a novel, at once a true crime thriller, courtroom drama, and miniature biography of Harper Lee. If To Kill a Mockingbird was one of your favorite books growing up, and whose wasn't it, you should add Furious Hours to your reading list today. How does that resonate with you?
Yeah, I mean, I keep wondering, you know, when the devil is going to show up and demand his compensation. I was just really lucky. I had a lot of really generous reviewers and, you know, people who wanted to know more about Harper Lee and wanted to understand the South. You know, there's a lot of Southern history in this book and people who are patient with a tangent. I mean, I do think hybrid is a very polite way of putting it. The book looks at a lot of different kinds of ways to tell a story and goes deep on some different kinds of history. You know, the history of the courts in Alabama, the history of life insurance, the history of hydroelectric power. I think, you know, it's a book for a certain kind of reader, and I feel really lucky that I found those.
Casey,
and,
how do you,
you know,
see
as far as comparison goes, I think she's one of the greatest American writers, so I just feel awfully flattered by the comparison. And I think it's just that there's so much of her in the book. It calls her to mind. You know, it's really over flattering to me, but probably, you know, she would have turned around and scoffed at it and thought, you know, that kid's got a lot of room to grow.
And how do you see audiences responding to Harper Lee now? You know, there is some controversy there, based on some of the language from To Kill a Mockingbird, and kind of takes heat back and forth from the left and the right. And to me, in many ways, your book is also kind of a defense of Harper Lee, her legacy, what she meant. So how do you interpret her legacy today?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And it comes from within Mockingbird, and it comes from within the book she published at the very end of her life, which, you know, really skewered Southern white moderates. And I think offered a portrayal of Atticus and a lot of kind of, you know, moderate whites in the South that was uncomfortable for people and felt incredibly contemporary. And I think in that sense, you know, Harper Lee was no fool. And the kind of fairy tale version of life in Mockingbird was one she could write, and she could write well, but it wasn't the only version of the South she knew. And I think her politics are a lot more complicated than people ever wanted to understand. You know, she was critical of the Freedom Riders when they were first undertaking their interstate bus travel. And so, you know, I think in some ways the book was always more liberal than she was. And I would like to think that some of what Furious Hours does is just help people understand who she was.
You know,
I don't think, you know, telling the truth about someone is, you know, apologizing for their politics. But I just think that's part of what will be interesting for people, is she's not the person I think a lot of us thought she was.
It's a great point, because there's such a bigger picture to this book than just the story of Willie Maxwell. And People magazine said, a brilliant take on the mystery of inspiration and the even darker mysteries of the human heart. When you talk about that, that's what people really get into, when you can extrapolate from the story into more of a metaphysical, epistemic approach to the human condition. That must make you feel like you've really accomplished something.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a book like To Kill a Mockingbird, which, you know, a lot of us loved when we were young, you just love it in a different way as an adult. And you see its complexities, and you see, you know, the truths and the, you know, falsehoods it tells or perpetuates or helps us look past. So I think the more complex a look we can give it, you know, objects we love or people we love, the better. And that's certainly for me the experience of writing the book. I admire Harper Lee in different ways than I did when I first started the research. And, you know, I think Alabama is a place that's complicated, and I got to spend a lot of time there and think about life there and get to know, you know, a lot of people on both sides of our political situation,
Casey,
interviewing them today. So it was a lot of fun.
You know, we only have about 20 seconds, and I have to ask you this question because Ben and I are sitting here in 10 seconds or less. When are we seeing this movie?
Oh, gosh. Well, you guys know better than I would. You know, start spreading copies around town. You're on the right coast for it.
Well, come talk to Ben. Yeah. He'll set
you
up.
A conversation.
we'll take care of you.
If this co-hosting gig doesn't take off.
Yeah. The book is called Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee. Casey Sepp, thanks for being with us on Gervie's Law today.
Thanks so much.
All right, take care. Ben Mycelis, thanks for being here. It's
thanks
so much
for having
fun
me.
Having you here.
Thanks for having me. We'll see what happens on Tuesday.
Midas Touch, Ben Mycelis. Don't miss it. Thanks for listening to Gervie's Law.
This show is furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.